I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this last day of 2015. El Nino is what we talk about this hour. Even the front page of today's New York Times asked the question, what is going on with the weather? Last week, as you know, it was incredibly warm. We finally had some snow, which I thought was welcome, because if you don't have a winter without snow, something weird is going on. Not that something weird isn't going on anyhow, but El Nino seems to be particularly strong this year, and it may be one of the strongest on record. So we thought we would spend an hour talking about what El Nino is, how long it has been tracked. I've read it's been tracked for about 300 years now. What makes it strong? How it will affect the United States and other parts of the world in which we live, and who better to talk about all of this than Professor Dan Vimont. He's Associate Professor of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, a member of the Nelson Institute Center for Climatic Research, and he knows a great deal about all of this. So we'll talk about the incredibly warm weather here. New York City, 71, 72 degrees the day before Christmas. Unbelievable. People were walking around in T-shirts. But there have also been severe problems, flooding, as you know, in Missouri, and tornadoes in the south, and very severe drought in parts of Africa, flooding you've probably read about in some cities in England. So we're looking at strange weather all over the world. How much of it is due to El Nino? Professor Dan Vimont, thank you very much for being with you and giving us all the answers this hour. Hi.
Hi. You're promising a lot from me here.
And you will deliver, I'm sure. And if you don't know, it's okay. It's at least, we'll be honest. So El Nino, let's just talk about what it is. It takes place in the Pacific. It's warmer temperatures in the Pacific somehow.
That's right. El Nino is a warming of the equatorial Pacific Ocean, so right along the equator, from about from the east side of the Pacific, so right off the coast of, say, Peru, and then extending all the way across the Pacific. Temperatures are abnormally warm, and this year they're they're really warm. It's one of the biggest events we've ever seen, and up to 3 degrees Celsius warmer than usual. Which may not sound like a lot, but it involves a complete reorganization of the entire tropical Pacific. So this is a big event.
And why is it warmer?
During an El Nino event, what happens is the warm water that typically is blown over to the western side of the Pacific, typically the East Pacific, is actually quite cool. Temperatures are around 22, 24 degrees Celsius, so, you know, 70 degrees thereabouts Fahrenheit. Whereas in the western Pacific, temperatures can get up to, of the ocean surface, can get up to the high 80s.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, up to 30 degrees Celsius and even higher in some places. But during an El Nino event, what happens is that typical distribution of temperature, it doesn't quite reverse, but all the cold water in the eastern Pacific warms up because for a number of reasons. That involve some really interesting processes between the atmosphere and the ocean. It requires both the atmosphere and the ocean to cooperate with each other in order to create that kind of warming.
Mm-hmm. And we get these, I've read, every 3 to 7 years, and it has always been so?
As far as we know, there may be periods deep in the past where El Nino has ceased, or we've had something that's like a permanent El Nino. But that's millions of years ago. And we do get these about every 3 to 7 years, but it's really rare to get one of this magnitude. And the three biggest that are on record are the 82-83 event, the 97-98 event, and the 2015-2016 event.
Mm-hmm. And there has been some mention, today's piece in the New York Times mentioned this, can we say, although we may not know for certainty, that because the planet is warming, that global warming may have something to do with the severity of an El Nino?
I think right now that would be a hypothesis that needs a lot more testing. One of the problems with having an event that occurs only 3 to 7 years is that we don't have a whole lot of these events to have very robust statistics on. So it could take us a century or so before we know whether or not global warming is having a significant impact on El Nino events.
Can you remember ever when it was 72 degrees in Central Park in New York City?
You know, I don't. It's but I don't. There and as a matter of fact, the records were broken all over the place. So I don't think anyone can remember that, right?
Right.
These kinds of records that are being broken right and left. To put things in perspective, December here in Madison was about 15 degrees warmer than usual.
This is
just amazing to me how warm it's been here. And Milwaukee's about the same. 2050, the National Weather Service has a nice page on El Nino and its impacts locally. From their page, Milwaukee experienced the warmest December ever on their record. And I believe Madison is either second or third in terms of the warmest ever. And incidentally, the other big warm year here in the other warm years in Milwaukee and Madison are also El Nino years.
That's fascinating. There is something weird about it, isn't it, though? When you go outside and you see crocuses bloom and it's December, you think something is off here. I don't think I like it.
Yeah, it is. It is off. For me, it's the lack of ice cover on the lakes.
Yes.
It just seems a little off.
It sure does. And it's really, maybe we're just hearing about the bad things that happen with El Nino. I don't know if they're good things, but the bad things are the significant flooding in certain parts of the world, England and certainly in Missouri we're hearing about today, and then horrible drought conditions in South Africa and in other parts in the southern hemisphere.
That's right. And also in Indonesia, which has been experiencing they experienced quite a drought during the pre-monsoon season. Which can really affect food security in those areas as well. So there, a lot of the one thing I will say is that we've been seeing impacts already. The current El Nino event is probably at its peak right now. It's probably going to start declining, but the impacts of El Nino will continue for another few months. So even though it's declining, or even though it looks like we've crossed we've crossed past the peak of this event, we still should be expecting impacts in the next several months.
And what does that mean? What kinds of impacts?
Some of the same things we've seen already, I think. So locally, we might the forecast is certainly for a warmer winter than usual. Wetter conditions in the south. And so you talk about some of the positive impacts of El Nino, and right now the Pacific Northwest has got slightly above their median snowpack for this time of year. That's a good thing. Mm-hmm. If they can keep it cool, and if it stays cool there and that snow doesn't melt and head down the mountains earlier, then that's going to be good for the Pacific Northwest. The Sierras are now at, I think, 110% of their median snowpack for this time of year. But again, it's important that they keep that snowpack for a little while. So there are some good impacts of this, but we've still got several months to go.
But the summer will be normal, whatever normal is now?
That's right. Usually El Nino peaks right around now. In fact, the name El Nino comes from the fact that it tends to peak, or it tends to, was originally noticed right after Christmas. So a little historical point here. El Nino is actually, as you pointed out, it's been known about for several hundred years. I don't know if several, but although it's really only been studied and monitored for maybe the last 120 or so. But early on, it was originally noticed by sailors off the coast of Peru who noticed a reversal of the Humboldt current off the coast of Peru. And with that reversal of that ocean current came all kinds of effects, changes to fisheries, rains that don't usually occur, and so forth. And that showed up right around Christmas time. So they referred to this as the coming of the child, or El Nino. And hence, we have El Nino. That's why we call it El Nino.
Well, if we've been studying this for 125 years, why is it going to take another 100 years to figure out what completely is going on?
Oh, let me clarify that. We have a lot of people looking at this problem right now as to how climate change may impact El Nino. The problem is that El Nino is very sensitive to the mean conditions or the average conditions in the Pacific. And so the models we have to study El Nino, if there's any issue, if there's any problems with the way they simulate the Pacific, then they have trouble simulating El Nino. And although we're able to simulate El Nino in these climate models, I'm still a little hesitant to say that we can simulate it well enough to reliably make a comment about whether or not climate change will be influencing El Nino.
I see.
So our models may come around so that they're good enough in the next, say, decade or so. But because the physical system, because these El Nino events happen so infrequently, and each one's different than the other than the next one. This one is a huge event, and some of the earlier ones haven't been this big. It's going to be hard for us to look at the physical, at the actual natural world, and say, yeah, there's a really clear trend with El Niño's getting more intense.
Okay.
Because that may take a long time before we're able to validate our theories.
And so they come, I've read, maybe every 3 years, maybe every 7 years. Isn't that strange for them to be so irregular, and why are they so irregular?
Yeah, it's not particularly strange. So an El Nino event lasts, well, I guess, says the guy who studies this, right? it is interesting that this occurs with this time scale. It is actually a fascinating phenomenon, and El Nino events kind of get going in spring, in boreal, so northern hemisphere springtime, although they happen around the equator, so around March or so, and then they start ramping up and really get going during, say, June, July, and August. That's when our predictability of El Nino improves, and that's where we can really start saying, all right, we're seeing conditions here that look like they're going to develop into an El Nino. And then once September, October, November comes around, that's when El Nino really takes off. Peaks right around December, and then it starts to decay, but the effects of El Nino will persist then for several months now. So the event itself lasts almost over a year. And because it involves such a huge reorganization of the Pacific, it takes a long time before the Pacific can kind of get back into a state that will allow an El Nino event to occur again. And so the 3 years is probably about is kind of the lower end of that. And every once in a while, one doesn't kick off for a while. And so it lasts, there's a good period of time before the next one occurs. And in between, maybe we'll have a La Nina event, which is kind of like an El Nino, except it's colder conditions in the tropical Pacific instead of warmer conditions.
So what do you see early on? What are you looking at in March that makes you believe it's going to happen?
There's a lot of things that are really interesting to look at, and one of the things that I like to look at is temperatures actually in the subtropics. So right around, say, 10 to 20 degrees of latitude. So not right on the equator. And some of the research that we've done here at the University of Wisconsin, and that's kind of taken off in looking at El Nino prediction and so forth, has shown that conditions in the subtropics could be very important for the development of El Nino. So I look at that, and then once conditions are kind of right for getting going, then the most important thing for me is temperatures below the surface in the equatorial Pacific. So from about the surface to, I don't know, 500 meters down. in the equatorial Pacific. And there's a and that's those are really important because you can really track the evolution of the event with that.
And because it's been going on for so long, you think sometimes that everything has a purpose. Is there a good purpose to this? Does it, does the ocean have to do this for some big reason?
That's a good question. You know, this gets into philosophical questions.
Sure.
Maybe we're humanizing the event, which I tend to overdo sometimes, you know, because even when you look at this all the time, it's like it's a friend or something, you know. It's,
I'm sure it is.
Yeah, but you know, so sorry to take a digression, but you know, part of me is kind of sad that this thing is starting to be on the decline.
Really?
Because this could be the last big event I ever see in my life.
Oh.
You know? I know, isn't that a sad thing to think about?
Oh.
No, there will be more events, but this one has been a really interesting one. So, yeah, is there a reason why this occurs? There are theories for why this could be a necessary thing for the tropical Pacific, that there's a buildup of heat in the western Pacific that needs to discharge. And that's one of the theories we have for why El Nino varies. I think that's probably a good way of thinking about that. El Nino releases a lot of heat from the tropical Pacific into the atmosphere and warms the entire globe. And so that release of heat from the tropical Pacific after it builds up for a period of time, that might be an answer to that question.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
We're going to be welcoming phone calls. We're talking about El Nino this hour, and it's big this year, as you heard our professor expert tell us. It has resulted in just bizarre weather in many parts of the world. And Professor Dan Vimont, Associate Professor of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, has been studying this and expecting it, seeing, as you heard him say, indications last March that we were going to have quite a year. And it turns out it may be the biggest El Nino ever, biggest that many of us will see in our lifetimes, and some people in some parts of the world will say, thank goodness for that. But in terms of looking at it as an event, it is something that if you do climate variability, then this is the event that you wait for, right? He is a member of the Nelson Institute Center for Climatic Research and co-chair of the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts. We welcome phone calls. What have you noticed with El Nino? Any questions that you have? I know that we're all experiencing it. We talk about it every day, right? Except today when we have 7 inches of snow, and it's a little chilly out. It's like winter, but it sure wasn't last week. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well @KDunnShow. So please call with your scientific questions or your observations. We would like very much to hear from you. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now, and Therese in Stevens Point, our first caller for you. Hi, Therese. Hi, Therese. In Stevens Point, are you there? Well, Therese isn't there, so let's go to Paul in Waukesha. Hi, Paul.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I was interested to find out, looking at El Nino, and I guess your expert says that it's only been observed for the past maybe a couple hundred years. Do we have an understanding of what percentage of human effects or humans are affecting the overall El Nino cycle, or what changes they're seeing in terms of percentage? Is it increasing? I mean, how do you measure that or gauge that?
That's a good question. How is El Nino influenced by human actions? And that's a really tough one to answer. There's a couple of theories out there. One of them suggests that El Nino events should become more intense just because of the warmer temperatures provides more energy for the atmospheric component of El Nino, which is during an El Nino event, the tropical atmosphere also has to cooperate, and that relies on rainfall and changes in the circulation of the atmosphere. And in a warmer overall climate, there's a lot more energy available for the atmosphere to really respond strongly to El Nino. But the problem is that there's also good theories for why El Nino should not get more intense. And right now we're in that stage of trying to figure out where does the balance lie here. And unfortunately, the balance requires a better knowledge of our of the mean state of the tropical Pacific, the average state of the tropical Pacific, than we actually have. And that sounds kind of strange these days to say that we don't know exactly what things look like in the tropical Pacific, but. Keep in mind, it's a tough place to go measure stuff. So we don't have a good metric for how much human actions may be influencing El Nino. We do have a good metric of how El Nino influences the global temperature. And so during El Nino events, the global temperature is much warmer than it usually is. So the 97-98 El Nino event, 98 was a very warm year due in part to the big El Nino event. This last year, it will be the warmest. This last year was the warmest on record. This next year will probably, if it doesn't beat last year, it'll probably match it in terms of how warm it'll be, unless a large La Nina event develops in the wake of this El Nino, which could happen. But your question, which relates to how humans are influencing El Nino, it's just a really hard hard question, and our understanding is in its infancy right now.
Hmm. Is that helpful, Paul?
Yes. And lastly, I've been reading about geoengineering, and it's never much talked about on the news, or I don't know if your expert knows much about geoengineering, but I believe it's referred to as kind of like weather wars.
Yeah.
I know military effects from China and Russia and the United States are all involved, and it's kind of a hush-hush topic, it seems. But it seems like they're able to manipulate and affect the weather conditions because it's plausible deniability. Well, it was on Mother Nature. We didn't have nothing to do with it. And they can create floods. And I guess the basis of the whole concept is that it's much cheaper to create a weather effect with this military technology and create a flood or tornadoes and what have you, and then to send in military troops. And it seems to be high priority on, I was listening to President Obama speak about, it's his number one priority, and I heard that's code word for weather wars.
Yeah, so I think the geoengineering for specific events like that just doesn't, the science has shown that it just doesn't work. I think when people are talking geoengineering these days, they're usually talking long-term geoengineering to counter the effects of climate change. So that would be things like taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and storing it somewhere, or doing something like increasing the amount of soot particles, they're called aerosols, that reflect solar radiation, increasing those, say, in the stratosphere. But those kinds of things, those aren't targeted, and those don't affect any individual event. So to put things in perspective, people always talked about, well, it would be great if we could change the path of a hurricane, right, by setting off a giant bomb or something like that. Hurricanes on a single day generate more energy than setting off, I think, something like 100 atomic bombs, right? So hurricanes are massively energetic, and there's just no way that we can do anything to alter that kind of an event. So when we talk about specific events like floods and so forth, that's just that's not That's just not something that's going to happen.
Thanks, Paul, for your call. You mentioned La Nina. Does a strong El Nino necessarily indicate that a strong La Nina will follow?
Well, not necessarily a strong La Nina, but it's very common for an El Nino event to be followed by a La Nina event. So a La Nina event is kind of the opposite conditions of El Nino, and this was another side story here. So this created all sorts of issues when we first were trying to figure out what we should call a cold event, because El Nino, as I said earlier, is named after the coming of the boy, of the Christ child, after Christmas in the tradition of the sailors in Peru. And so initially we thought, well, we'll call a cold event a anti-El Nino. But that's kind of like referring to it as the Antichrist, which no one liked. So La Nina is the next best thing. So that also has its connotations that people don't care for. And so oftentimes in scientific circles, we refer to it as as a cold event. But the La Nina, that has become the opposite of El Nino. So, they typically do follow really big El Nino events, but this one, there's some differences in this event that I'll be really curious to see what happens in the coming year, whether or not we get a La Nina. There's no guarantee it'll be a big one if we get a La Nina.
And would it happen in the next year? Or
yes.
It would?
Yeah, it would probably, it would probably peak sometime around a year from now.
And you seemed a little bit secretive when you were saying, but this year, and then you didn't really finish it. So what are you thinking?
Well, this year's been very interesting. There's some very big differences between the evolution of this event and some of the other big events we've had. So the 97-98 El Nino event was followed by a couple of years of cold conditions in the tropical Pacific. The subsurface, the temperatures under the surface, so around, say, 250 meters below the surface in the equatorial Pacific, the evolution was very different during the 97-98 El Nino event. And this one has not seen the very large temperature anomalies below the surface that were really prevalent in that one. And that could be a data issue. It could also be that this is evolving a little differently, and I'm really curious to see what happens in the next year.
Art in Beach Park, Illinois. Hi, Art.
Hi. The host asked you earlier about some positives of El Nino, and according to what I've read, it usually means a very light hurricane season in the Atlantic. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's usually, though, during the development of the El Nino, and so that would have been last hurricane season. And, in fact, we saw a pretty light hurricane season last summer. And so what happens during an El Nino event is the atmosphere in the tropics gets warmer than it usually is. But it's the vertical distribution of warmth is such that it can suppress some of the convection that leads to hurricanes. The other thing that happens is you end up with what's referred to as vertical wind shear. And now I'm getting real technical here. That's when winds at the surface are moving a slightly different direction that winds are up higher in the atmosphere. And what that tends to do is it tends to shear apart the convection and clouds and stuff that leads to hurricane activity. Mm. So this coming season, that effect is not going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right, absolutely. The previous hurricane season was really light, and we had two things going for that. Well, the big El Nino and then conditions in the Atlantic, and both were really pointing towards a light season.
Anything else, Art?
That's all. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Thanks for the comment.
Therese in Stevens Point. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for getting me back on again. I Phil must have dropped a call or something. But my question is, I've heard of something called the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. It also has to do, I guess, with temperatures in the Pacific. Is that at all related or connected to El Nino in any way? And if it's different, how is it different, and how does that affect our weather patterns?
Great question. Boy, this is another area of research for me. So thanks for asking that. It's like I'm priming these. So the Pacific Decadal Oscillation is a kind of a longer-term variation in the North Pacific. And actually, El Nino can influence the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. So the Pacific Decadal Oscillation is kind of an interesting beast. One of the issues with the differences between El Nino and the Pacific Decadal Oscillation is that El Nino can have a really big influence on the mid-latitude atmosphere, and so around where we live, it can really affect the jets and so forth. And so there's a clear causality between El Nino causing a change in the mid-latitude atmosphere. The Pacific Decadal Oscillation, on the other hand, is influenced by the mid-latitude atmosphere. And so El Nino can influence the mid-latitude atmosphere and in turn affect the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. But the Pacific Decadal Oscillation does not have a very big effect on the mid-latitude atmosphere. So the causality there is from atmosphere to the ocean. And so there's not very good predictability of what we might care about. Now, on the flip side, if you're a salmon fisherman, you may care a lot about the Pacific Decadal Oscillation because there's a very strong relationship between what happens in the ocean and, say, salmon recruitment in Alaska versus the Pacific Northwest. Mm-hmm. And so those impacts may be more directly attributable to this Pacific Decadal Oscillation.
And what if you're a fish in the middle of the Pacific Ocean and it's 3 degrees warmer? What does that do to your life?
It depends on the fish. Right now, the algae blooms in the Pacific that are shutting down the Dungeness crab industry. I don't know if anyone. I'm originally from Seattle, Dungeness crab to me is the Dungeness crab and salmon are the two tops for me. Mm-hmm. And the Dungeness crab season is you can't get Dungeness crab right now because the blooms in the Pacific have made it toxic to eat.
Ooh.
Yeah, so that's a big hit to that industry. Coral, warm temperatures are really bad for coral. So this is going to be a big coral bleaching event this year. And so, you know, those are the sort of things we don't like to see. But on the flip side, it depends on the species. There are some species that may respond favorably to the changes in conditions associated with El Nino.
Therese, thank you. Diane in Tucson, Arizona. Hi, Diane.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Okay, I'm a transplanted Wisconsinite out here, and I'm just wondering, we are freezing to death out here. Freezing to death, and it's awfully cold. It's in 50s and 60s. It's unheard of. We're supposed to be swimming, you know? Okay, what's going to happen in January? That's number one, January and February, but also, is it going to be any cooler this summer?
That is a good question, and unfortunately, I am not particularly well. well versed on Tucson temperatures. I will say that the near-term forecast looks like you might get some warm weather this weekend there, but. One thing that does happen with El Nino is it tends to generate cooler conditions in the south and wetter conditions in the south. So I hate to break the news to you that that if you're going just by El Nino, doesn't look so great for super warm. But you know, if you're a transplanted Wisconsinite, I mean, come on, 50s and 60s.
That's what we had for Christmas.
It was warm.
It's all a matter of what's in your mind about it, right?
that's right. No, I do appreciate that, though. One of the things is we do sort of get accustomed to the kind of conditions that we experience, and just like, you know, our temperatures outside in the 30s and 40s might be ridiculously cold to someone in Florida. For us, we look out and we see the lack of ice and so forth, and that's a big impact for us. So, but in terms of the long term, the medium range forecast locally, it looks like we'll get some cold temperatures in the next few days. But then the 6 to 10 day outlook is for warming up. And the 10 to 3 month outlook is for a milder winter still. So continued warm conditions in the Midwest, and then in the South in Tucson and across the entire southern U.S. Wetter and cooler conditions.
Hmm. Well, Diane,
thanks for letting me give you a bad time about.
Right.
That's all right. Thanks for the nice program. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Diane. Thanks for calling. Ron in Marshfield. Hi.
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 Listen, what's really disturbing to me is I've heard on NPR that there is a drought in the rainforest in Central America and South America, and I'm going, what's going on with that, you know?
Yeah, that's so. One of the impacts of that is one of the impacts of El Nino is that there tends to be drier conditions, especially in the northern part of the Amazon, and could be through parts of Central America as well. But these are variations that occur from year to year, and so this is something that the system, this isn't probably going to be a collapse of the rainforest or anything like that. So, but that is an impact of El Nino, that the conditions over the Amazon tend to be a little drier than usual. Other places where there are big impacts are certainly Indonesia, and the we saw that with the fires and the soot from the fires. And then South Africa as well, drier conditions, and that's something that has a big impact on agriculture in that region. So the impacts of El Nino, even if we're past the peak of the El Nino, or even if we're right about it, at it now, the impacts, the physical impacts, are still going to happen for another few months, and the social impacts may continue for another year or so, just as people are gradually recover from them.
Right. Marcus writes on Facebook, are there any new and improved U.S. weather satellites going up anytime soon?
We've got a couple of great weather satellites up there right now. One of them is actually named after, and this is, you know, Oorah, Wisconsin. This is named after one of the first professors at the University of Wisconsin in the Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences program, Werner Sumi. And so the Sumi satellite is able to, one of the things that's really hard to do from space is get an estimate of rainfall rates, believe it or not. There's a lot of reasons for that. And this instrument is able to get a vertical distribution a number of satellites are able to get vertical distributions, but this is one that's being used that's supposed to be able to get a better estimate of rainfall rates. And I'm not doing justice to this. My colleagues, if they're listening right now, are rolling their eyes and getting angry with me for not explaining that well. But the other thing I'll say this related, though, that's a very important tool that we have is called the Tropical Atmosphere Ocean Array. And it's a buoy, it's an array of buoys in the tropical Pacific. And it doesn't sound very exciting, but this is the most important tool that we have to monitor and predict El Niños. These give us real-time measurements of what the temperature of the ocean is, say 250 meters below the surface. That's not a trivial thing at all. And those measurements are critical. The problem is that that array is no longer in marked for funding from the U.S. here.
Really?
That's right. We are hopefully relying on some more international partnerships to maintain that array, but there's no guarantee that we'll be able to maintain the consistency that we need from an array like that. And it's just a critical monitoring and prediction tool. As I said, the most important thing that any of us look at in looking at the evolution of El Nino is subsurface temperatures.
Mm-hmm. So who do we write to? We got to have that going on.
Yeah, write to your Congress representatives and write to NOAA. And this is an important thing for us to maintain.
And where is it?
It's all across the tropical Pacific.
I see.
It's actually a very interesting problem. How do you moor a buoy in 4 kilometers of water? Because if the cable's too long, it floats around too much, and you don't get accurate readings. And if it's too short, it sinks. So the whole process of how you drop this buoy in the Pacific, especially the kilometer of monitoring information and Kevlar rope at the top of this, is a very interesting engineering problem.
Mm. More phone calls in a moment. We're talking about El Nino and related topics with our very informative guest, Professor Dan Vimont. He's Associate Professor of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, a member of the Nelson Institute Center for Climatic Research, and co-chair of the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts. And we're delighted to have him with us. We should also tell you that Wisconsin Public Radio has done a whole long series of articles on the complex cycle of El Nino. It's just one facet of a complex cycle. So if you want to read more about this, here's a handy place to go. If you go to wpr.org/El Nino, there will be a whole series of articles so you can carry this conversation on beyond today. More phone calls momentarily. 800-486-8655 is our number. Ron, thanks for your call. A couple lines are open. If you would prefer to send an email, it's talk@wpr.org. If you would prefer to go on Facebook, it's the Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter is @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Rod in Weyerhaeuser, our next caller for you. Hi, Rod.
Good program. Another good program, Kathleen. Thank you. I had a question. Kind of. My dad's 93, and he said he can remember the winter of 35, 36, I guess, for 30 days and 30 nights. He says it never got above zero, you know, for even highs and during the day. And then I think he said, I don't know if it was the summer that followed that or the previous summer, was the summer of fires. They were trying to wet the sheets, you know, with water just to stay cool.
Oh.
If your guest has any records on that, was that like an El Nino? And then if the hot summer followed, if that was what does that mean?
Let's see, 34 and 35, 1934 and 35.
I think he said...
he always said 35, 36, I believe. And then I don't know if it was the following summer was so hot. There was fires. His uncle that was a bachelor, they hired him. A lot of people, if they could, they hired him to be out at night because there was fires everywhere. That was the summer that followed the cold winter, I think, 36, 37.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't have any records of that. Let's see, I can look quickly here. The 35 and 36 was not an El Nino year or a La Nina year. The previous year, 33, 34 was a mild El Nino year, but nothing really strong. Thanks for bringing that up. That's a really I'll take a look back then. I do know that around that time there were some very very abnormal years in Wisconsin, and that brings up a really good point that that year-to-year variations occur for a lot of reasons. There's El Nino, which can cause this kind of crazy stuff that's going on this year. But there's also just natural random variations, and we don't like to think, you know, we don't like to think that or just attribute stuff to random variations. But it is a reality that, you know, we all know that 1 year can be different than the next, and we might not be able to pin it down to one particular cause. But I'll look up that extreme cold and extreme warm summer after that. Thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah, thank you, Rod, so much. Tom in Seattle. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Dan.
Hello.
You know each other?
What I wanted to know is, after our near-record rainfall this December, can we expect that the new year is going to be drier than usual, somewhat similar to last year? Or do you have any thoughts about how that might play out?
Well, hello there, Dad.
Oh, this is your dad.
I guess they must be listening from the Pacific Northwest. Tom from Seattle, Washington. So the Pacific Northwest. I will point out that he asked me earlier this year whether or not he should get new ski equipment, and my suggestion to him was that there would be some good deals on lately used equipment by the end of the year. That being said, the snowpack in the Cascades, I was dead wrong on that. For now, the snowpack in the Cascades is higher than is over the median. But as pointed out to me by another climate expert in the region, the last year it was also higher than usual, but then they were struck with a little bit of drought last year. So the long-term forecast for the Pacific Northwest is actually a little warmer than usual, but the relationship is, I'd say, it's not quite as robust as some of the other areas. It is one of the areas, though, that does tend to be a little warmer than usual during the winter months. And in terms of precipitation, it's just hard to know. I mean, in the Seattle area, there's no shortage of rainfall. The question is whether or not that rainfall falls as typically there's no shortage of rainfall. The question is whether or not that rainfall falls as snow, which is what they require for water year, the hydrological cycle, their water resources, or whether it falls as rain. And the projected outlook of warmer temperatures is not good for that region. However, hopefully that random component kicks in and it stays snowy. Hmm.
So,
all right,
Tom,
thank you.
Before you go, Tom, were you influential? Did you and Dan look at the weather every day and read the forecasts?
No, he got interested in it on his own, and he's done very well with it.
Yes, he has.
That's not exactly true. So I got interested in this because my dad and I would go out hiking about once a week, and I'd be hiking through 5 feet of snow in the mountains in July. And I thought to myself, this is what I want to do for a living. So, okay.
Very good.
Give yourself some more credit.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much. Family's all enjoyed listening to you, and we appreciate NPR.
Thanks. Thank you, Tom. Thanks for calling. Isn't that a nice thought? There's your family listening to you in Seattle. Dan.
I didn't prime these questions.
No.
Too much.
No.
I did tell them to listen.
Okay. And they did, and they called. That's good. Thank you for the call. David in Rockford, Illinois. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I recall that there was a major drought in the Midwest in 83, and you had said that the most major El Nino previously was in 82.
Yeah.
In 82, there was a bumper crop of corn and soybeans produced in the Midwest. There were just piles stored outside big pyramids. And then in 83, there was extreme heat and drought. I recall, you know, several days being above 100 degrees in the spring.
Wow.
I wonder if there's any correlation.
That's a good question. So the one thing with so for 83 the There was some very, yeah, you're right. During during late February and March, temperatures were up. There was a stretch there where they got up into the 60s and 70s, and during the summer then was a slightly warmer than usual during 83. There's not a strong relationship between El Nino and precipitation in the Midwest. There's a much stronger relationship between El Nino and temperature. That being said, it does tend to be a little drier. However, I like to use the analogy of loading the dice. El Nino tends to load the dice one way or the other. And for temperature, those dice are a little more loaded than they are for precipitation. If there was a drought that year, I'd be hard-pressed to necessarily attribute that to El Nino. Again, it may be one of these random variations, but also an important one for us to understand and for us to recognize and especially due to the, as you say, the potential agricultural consequences of that.
Yeah, thanks, David, so much. Well, thank you so much, Professor Vimont, for being with us. Anytime, come back. It was great.
Yeah, it's always good questions from listeners. So thanks a lot, everyone.
Great, thank you. Thanks for being with us, Dan Vimont, Associate Professor of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, talking about El Nino. We're with you again on Monday, All Things Political, with Julian Zelizar from Princeton University. And hour two is we'll talk about 2015, the new warmest year on record. Our guest will be someone who's from the delegation of Pakistan at the opening of the Paris negotiations. Thanks to KP Whaley and Scotty Myers for production.